This is disc number 6.
Then arose a slim, melancholy girl, whose face had the interesting paleness that comes of pills and indigestion, and read a poem. 2 stanzas of it will do.
A Missouri maiden's farewell to Alabama. Alabama, goodbye, I love thee well, but yet for a while do I leave thee now. Sad, yes, sad thoughts of thee my heart doth swell, and burning recollections throng my brow. For I have wandered through thy flowery woods, have roamed and read near Tallapoosa's stream, have listened to Tallahassee's warring floods, and wooed on Coosa's side Aurora's beam. Yet shame I not to bear an o'erfull heart, nor blush to turn behind my tearful eyes. 'Tis from no stranger land I now must part, 'tis to no strangers left I yield thee sighs. Welcome and home were mine within this state, whose vales I leave, whose spires fade fast from me, and cold must be mine eyes, and heart, and tate, when, dear Alabama, they turn cold on thee. There were very few there who knew what tate meant, but the poem was very satisfactory, nevertheless. Next appeared a dark-complexioned, black-eyed, black-haired young lady who paused an impressive moment, assumed a tragic expression, and began to read in a measured, solemn tone.
A vision. Dark and tempestuous was night. Around the throne on high, not a single star quivered, but the deep intonations of the heavy thunder constantly vibrated upon the ear, whilst the terrific lightning reveled in angry mood through the cloudy chambers of heaven, seeming to scorn the power exerted over its terror by the illustrious Franklin. Even the boisterous winds unanimously came forth from their mystic homes and blustered about as if to enhance by their aid the wildness of the scene. At such a time, so dark, so dreary, for human sympathy, my very spirit sighed. But instead thereof, my dearest friend, my counselor, my comforter and guide, my joy in grief, my second bliss in joy, came to my side. She moved like one of those bright beings pictured in the sunny walks of fancy's Eden by the romantic and young. A queen of beauty, unadorned save by her own transcendent loveliness. So soft was her step, it failed to make even a sound. And but for the magical thrill imparted by her genial touch, as other unobtrusive beauties, she would have glided away unperceived, unsought. A strange sadness rested upon her features, like icy tears upon the robe of December, as she pointed to the contending elements without and bade me contemplate the 2 beings presented.
This nightmare occupied some 10 pages of manuscript, and wound up with a sermon so destructive of all hope to non-Presbyterians that it took the first prize. This composition was considered to be the very finest effort of the evening. The mayor of the village, in delivering the prize to the author of it, made a warm speech in which he said that it was by far the most eloquent thing he had ever listened to, and that Daniel Webster himself might well be proud of it. It may be remarked, in passing, that the number of compositions in which the word beauteous was overfondled and human experience referred to as life's page was up to the usual average. Now the master, mellow almost to the verge of geniality, put his chair aside, turned his back to the audience, and began to draw a map of America on the blackboard to exercise the geography class upon. But he made a sad business of it with his unsteady hand, and a smothered titter rippled over the house. He knew what the matter was and set himself to write it. He sponged out lines and remade them, but he only distorted them more than ever, and the tittering was more pronounced. He threw his entire attention upon his work now, as if determined not to be put down by the mirth. He felt that all eyes were fastened upon him. He imagined he was succeeding, and yet the tittering continued. It even manifestly increased. And well it might. There was a garret above, pierced with a scuttle over his head, and down through this scuttle came a cat, suspended around the haunches by a string. She had a rag tied about her head and jaws to keep her from mewing. As she slowly descended, she curved upward and clawed at the string. She swung downward and clawed at the intangible air. The tittering rose higher and higher. The cat was within 6 inches of the absorbed teacher's head. Down, down, a little lower, and she grabbed his wig with her desperate claws, clung to it, and was snatched up into the garret in an instant with her trophy still in her possession. And how the light did blaze abroad from the master's bald pate, for the sign painter's boy had gilded it. That broke up the meeting. The boys were avenged. Vacation had come. Note: the pretended compositions quoted in this chapter are taken without alteration from a volume entitled Prose and Poetry by a Western Lady, but they are exactly and precisely after the schoolgirl pattern and hence are much happier than any mere imitations could be. Chapter 22. Huck Finn Quotes Scripture. Tom joined the new order of cadets of temperance, being attracted by the showy character of their regalia. He promised to abstain from smoking, chewing, and profanity as long as he remained a member. Now he found out a new thing, namely, that to promise not to do a thing is the surest way in the world to make a body want to go and do that very thing. Tom soon found himself tormented with a desire to drink and swear. The desire grew to be so intense that nothing but the hope of a chance to display himself in his red sash kept him from withdrawing from the order. 4th of July was coming, but he soon gave that up. Gave it up before he had worn his shackles over 48 hours, and fixed his hopes upon old Judge Frazier, Justice of the Peace, who was apparently on his deathbed and would have a big public funeral since he was so high an official. During 3 days, Tom was deeply concerned about the judge's condition and hungry for news of it. Sometimes his hopes ran high, so high that he would venture to get out his regalia and practice before the looking-glass. But the judge had a most discouraging way of fluctuating. At last he was pronounced upon the mend, and then convalescent. Tom was disgusted, and felt a sense of injury, too. He handed in his resignation at once, and that night the judge suffered a relapse and died. Tom resolved that he would never trust a man like that again. The funeral was a fine thing. The cadets paraded in a style calculated to kill the late member with envy. Tom was a free boy again, however. There was something in that. He could drink and swear now, but found to his surprise that he did not want to. The simple fact that he could took the desire away and the charm of it. Tom presently wondered to find that his coveted vacation was beginning to hang a little heavily on his hands. He attempted a diary, but nothing happened during 3 days, and so he abandoned it. The first of all the Negro minstrel shows came to town and made a sensation. Tom and Joe Harper got up a band of performers and were happy for 2 days. Even the Glorious Fourth was in some sense a failure, for it rained hard. There was no procession in consequence, and the greatest man in the world, as Tom supposed, Mr. Benton, an actual United States senator, proved an overwhelming disappointment, for he was not 25 feet high, nor even anywhere in the neighborhood of it. A circus game. The boys played circus for 3 days afterwards in tents made of rag carpeting. Admission, 3 pins for boys, 2 for girls. And then circusing was abandoned. A phrenologist and a mesmerizer came and went again and left the village duller and drearier than ever. There were some boys and girls parties, but they were so few and so delightful that they only made the aching voids between ache the harder. Becky Thatcher was gone to her Constantinople home to stay with her parents during vacation, so there was no bright side to life anywhere. The dreadful secret of the murder was a chronic misery. It was a very cancer for permanency and pain. Then came the measles. During 2 long weeks, Tom lay a prisoner, dead to the world and its happenings. He was very ill. He was interested in nothing. When he got upon his feet at last and moved feebly downtown, a melancholy change had come over everything and every creature. There had been a revival, and everybody had got religion. Not only the adults, but even the boys and girls. Tom went about hoping against hope for the sight of one blessed, sinful face. But disappointment crossed him everywhere. He found Joe Harper studying a testament and turned sadly away from the depressing spectacle. He sought Ben Rogers and found him visiting the poor with a basket of tracts. He hunted up Jim Hollis, who called his attention to the precious blessing of his late measles as a warning. Every boy he encountered added another ton to his depression, and when, in desperation, he flew for refuge at last to the bosom of Huckleberry Finn and was received with a scriptural quotation, his heart broke, and he crept home and to bed, realizing that he alone of all the town was lost forever and forever. And that night there came on a terrific storm, with driving rain, awful claps of thunder, and blinding sheets of lightning. He covered his head with the bedclothes and waited in a horror of suspense for his doom, for he had not the shadow of a doubt that all this hubbub was about him. He believed he had taxed the forbearance of the powers above to the extremity of endurance, and that this was the result. It might have seemed to him a waste of pomp and ammunition to kill a bug with a battery of artillery, but there seemed nothing incongruous about the getting up such an expensive thunderstorm as this to knock the turf from under an insect like himself. By and by, the tempest spent itself and died without accomplishing its object. The boy's first impulse was to be grateful and reform. His second was to wait, for there might not be any more storms. The next day, the doctors were back. Tom had relapsed. The 3 weeks he spent on his back this time seemed an entire age. When he got abroad at last, he was hardly grateful that he had been spared, remembering how lonely was his estate, how companionless and forlorn he was. He drifted listlessly down the street and found Jim Hollis acting as judge in a juvenile court that was trying a cat for murder in the presence of her victim, a bird. He found Joe Harper and Huck Finn up an alley eating a stolen melon. Poor lads, they, like Tom, had suffered a relapse. Chapter 23, The Salvation of Muff Potter. At last the sleepy atmosphere was stirred, and vigorously the murder trial came on in the court. It became the absorbing topic of village talk immediately. Tom could not get away from it. Every reference to the murder sent a shudder to his heart, for his troubled conscience and fears almost persuaded him that these remarks were put forth in his hearing as feelers. He did not see how he could be suspected of knowing anything about the murder, but still, he could not be comfortable in the midst of this gossip. It kept him in a cold shiver all the time. He took Huck to a lonely place to have a talk with him. It would be some relief to unseal his tongue for a little while, to divide his burden of distress with another sufferer. Moreover, he wanted to assure himself that Huck had remained discreet.
Huck, have you ever told anybody about that?
That what?
You know what?
Oh, of course I haven't.
Never a word?
Never a solitary word, so help me.
What makes you ask?
Well, I was afeard.
Why, Tom Sawyer, we wouldn't be alive 2 days if that got found out. You know that.
Tom felt more comfortable. After a pause,
Huck, they couldn't anybody get you to tell, could they?
Get me to tell? Why, if I wanted that half-breed devil to drown me, they could get me to tell. There ain't no different way.
Well, that's all right, then. I reckon we're safe as long as we keep mum, but let's swear again, anyway. It's more sure.
I'm agreed.
So they swore again with dread solemnities.
What is the talk around, Huck? I've heard a power of it.
Talk? Well, it's just Muff Potter, Muff Potter, Muff Potter all the time. Keeps me in a sweat constant, so's I want to hide somewheres.
That's just the same way they go on round me. I reckon he's a goner. Don't you feel sorry for him sometimes?
Most always.
Most always.
He ain't no account. But then, he ain't never done anything to hurt anybody. Just fishes a little to get money to get drunk on and loafs around considerable. But, Lord, we all do that.
Leastways, most of us. Preachers and such like. But he's kind of good.
He give me half a fish once when there weren't enough for two. And lots of times he's kind of stood by me when I was out of luck.
Well, he's mended kites for me, Huck, and knitted hooks onto my line. I wish we could get him out of there.
My, we couldn't get him out, Tom. And besides, 'twouldn't do any good they catch him again.
Yes, so they would. But I hate to hear him abuse him so, like the Dickens, when he never done that.
I do too, Tom.
Lord, I hear him say he's the bloodiest looking villain in this country, and they wonder he wasn't ever hung before.
Yes, they talk like that all the time. I've heard him say that if he was to get free, they'd lynch him, and they'd do it too.
The boys had a long talk, but it brought them little comfort. As the twilight drew on, they found themselves hanging about the neighborhood of the little isolated jail, perhaps with an undefined hope that something would happen that might clear away their difficulties. But nothing happened, There seemed to be no angels or fairies interested in this luckless captive. The boys did as they had often done before, went to the cell grating and gave Potter some tobacco and matches. He was on the ground floor, and there were no guards. His gratitude for their gifts had always smote their consciences before. It cut deeper than ever this time. They felt cowardly and treacherous to the last degree when Potter said,
"You've been mighty good to me, boys. Better than anybody else in this town. And I don't forget it. I don't. Often I says to myself, says I used to mend all the boys' kites and things, and show 'em where the good fishing places was, and befriend 'em what I could. And now they've all forgot old Muff when he's in trouble. But Tom don't, and Huck don't. They don't forget him, says I. And I don't forget them. Well, boys, I done an awful thing. Drunk and crazy at the time. That's the only way I account for it. And now I got the swing for it. And it's right. Right and best, too, I reckon. Hope so, anyway. Well, we won't talk about that. I don't want to make you feel bad. You befriended me. But what I want to say is, don't you ever get drunk. Then you won't ever get here. Stand a little further west. So, that's it. Oh, it's a prime comfort to see faces that's friendly when a body's in such a muck of trouble. And there don't none come here but yourn. Good, friendly faces. Good, friendly faces. Get up on one another's backs and let me touch 'em. That's it. Shake hands. Yourn will come through the bars, but mine's too big. Little hands and weak. But they've helped Muff Potter a power, and they'd help me more if they could.
Tom went home miserable. And his dreams that night were full of horrors. The next day and the day after, he hung about the courtroom, drawn by an almost irresistible impulse to go in, but forcing himself to stay out. Huck was having the same experience. They studiously avoided each other. Each wandered away from time to time, but the same dismal fascination always brought them back presently. Tom kept his ears open when Idler sauntered out of the courtroom, but invariably heard distressing news. The toils were closing more and more relentlessly around poor Potter. At the end of the second day, the village talk was to the effect that Injun Joe's evidence stood firm and unshaken, and that there was not the slightest question as to what the jury's verdict would be. Tom was out late that night and came to bed through the window. He was in a tremendous state of excitement. It was hours before he got to sleep. All the village flocked to the courthouse the next morning, for this was to be the great day. Both sexes were about equally represented in the packed audience. After a long wait, the jury filed in and took their places. Shortly afterward, Potter, pale and haggard, timid and hopeless, was brought in, with chains upon him, and seated where all the curious eyes could stare at him. No less conspicuous was Injun Joe, stolid as ever. There was another pause, and then the judge arrived, and the sheriff proclaimed the opening of the court. The usual whisperings among the lawyers and gathering together of papers followed. These details and accompanying delays worked up an atmosphere of preparation that was as impressive as it was fascinating. Now, a witness was called who testified that he found Muff Potter washing in the brook at an early hour of the morning that the murder was discovered, and that he immediately sneaked away. After some further questioning, counsel for the prosecution said, "Take the witness." The prisoner raised his eyes for a moment but dropped them again when his own counsel said, "I have no questions to ask him." The next witness proved the finding of the knife near the corpse. Counsel for the prosecution said, "Take the witness." "I have no questions to ask him," Potter's lawyer replied. A third witness swore he had often seen the knife in Potter's possession. "Take the witness." Counsel for Potter declined to question him. The faces of the audience began to betray annoyance. Did this attorney mean to throw away his client's life without an effort? Several witnesses deposed concerning Potter's guilty behavior when brought to the scene of the murder. They were allowed to leave the stand without being cross-questioned. Every detail of the damaging circumstances that occurred in the graveyard upon that morning, which all present remembered so well, was brought out by credible witnesses, but none of them were cross-examined by Potter's lawyer. The perplexity and dissatisfaction of the House expressed itself in murmurs and provoked a reproof from the bench. Counsel for the prosecution now said, "By the oaths of citizens whose simple word is above suspicion, we have fastened this awful crime beyond all possibility of question upon the unhappy prisoner at the bar. We rest our case here." A groan escaped from poor Potter, and he put his face in his hands and rocked his body softly to and fro, while a painful silence reigned in the courtroom. Many men were moved, and many women's compassion testified itself in tears. Counsel for the defense rose and said, "Your Honor, in our remarks at the opening of this trial, we foreshadowed our purpose to prove that our client did this fearful deed while under the influence of a blind and irresponsible delirium produced by drink. We have changed our mind. We shall not offer that plea." Then to the clerk, "Call Thomas Sawyer." A puzzled amazement awoke in every face in the house, not even excepting Potter's. Every eye fastened itself with wondering interest upon Tom as he rose and took his place upon the stand. The boy looked wild enough, for he was badly scared. The oath was administered. "Thomas Sawyer, where were you on the 17th of June about the hour of midnight?" Tom glanced at Injun Joe's iron face, and his tongue failed him. The audience listened, breathless, but the words refused to come. After a few moments, however, the boy got a little of his strength back and managed to put enough of it into his voice to make part of the house hear, "In the graveyard."
"A little bit louder, please. Don't be afraid. You were..."
"In the graveyard." A contemptuous smile flitted across Injun Joe's face.
"Were you anywhere near Horse Williams's grave?"
"Yes, sir."
"Speak up just a trifle louder. How near were you?"
"Near as I am to you."
"Were you hidden or not?"
"I was hid."
"Where?"
"Behind the elms that's on the edge of the grave."
Injun Joe gave a barely perceptible start.
"Anyone with you?"
"Yes, sir. I went there with..."
Wait a moment. Never mind mentioning your companion's name. We will produce him at the proper time. Did you carry anything there with you?" Tom hesitated and looked confused.
"Speak out, my boy. Don't be diffident. The truth is always respectable." What did you take there?
Only a dead cat.
There was a ripple of mirth, which the court checked.
We will produce the skeleton of that cat. Now, my boy, tell us everything that occurred. Tell it in your own way. Don't skip anything, and don't be afraid.
Tom began, hesitatingly at first, but as he warmed to his subject, his words flowed more and more easily. In a little while, every sound ceased but his own voice. Every eye fixed itself upon him. With parted lips and bated breath, the audience hung upon his words, taking no note of time, wrapped in the ghastly fascinations of the tale. The strain upon Pentamotion reached its climax when the boy said,
"And as the doctor fetched the board around and Muff Potter fell, Injun Joe jumped with the knife and crash!"
Quick as lightning, the half-breed sprang for a window, tore his way through all opposers, and was gone. Chapter 24. Splendid Days and Fearsome Nights. Tom was a glittering hero once more, the pet of the old, the envy of the young. His name even went into immortal print, for the village paper magnified him. There were some that believed he would be president yet, if he escaped hanging. As usual, the fickle, unreasoning world took Muff Potter to its bosom and fondled him as lavishly as it had abused him before. But that sort of conduct is to the world's credit, therefore it is not well to find fault with it. Tom's days were days of splendor and exultation to him, but his nights were seasons of horror. Injun Joe infested all his dreams, and always with doom in his eye. Hardly any temptation could persuade the boy to stir abroad after nightfall. Poor Huck was in the same state of wretchedness and terror, for Tom had told the whole story to the lawyer the night before the great day of the trial, and Huck was sore afraid that his share in the business might leak out yet, notwithstanding Injun Joe's flight had saved him the suffering of testifying in court. The poor fella had got the attorney to promise secrecy, but what of that? Since Tom's harassed conscience had managed to drive him to the lawyer's house by night and wring a dread tale from lips that had been sealed with the dismalest and most formidable of oaths, Huck's confidence in the human race was well nigh obliterated. Daily, Muff Potter's gratitude made Tom glad he had spoken, but nightly, he wished he had sealed up his tongue. Half the time, Tom was afraid Injun Joe would never be captured. The other half, he was afraid he would be. He felt sure he never could draw a safe breath again until that man was dead and he had seen the corpse. Rewards had been offered. The country had been scoured, but no Injun Joe was found. One of those omniscient and awe-inspiring marvels, a detective, came up from St. Louis, moused around, shook his head, looked wise, and made that sort of astounding success which members of that craft usually achieve. That is to say, he found a clue. But you can't hang a clue for murder. And so after that detective had got through and gone home, Tom felt just as insecure as he was before. The slow days drifted on, and each left behind it a slightly lightened weight of apprehension. Chapter 25. Seeking the Buried Treasure. There comes a time in every rightly constructed boy's life when he has a raging desire to go somewhere and dig for hidden treasure. This desire suddenly came upon Tom one day. He sallied out to find Joe Harper, but failed of success. Next, he sought Ben Rogers. He had gone fishing. Presently, he stumbled upon Huck Finn, the red-handed.
Huck would answer.
Tom took him to a private place and opened the matter to him, confidentially.
Huck was willing. Huck was always willing to take a hand in any enterprise that offered entertainment and required no capital, for he had a troublesome superabundance of that sort of time which is not money.
"Where'll we dig?" said Huck.
"Oh, most anywhere."
"Why, is it hid all around?"
"No, indeed it ain't. It's hid in mighty particular places, Huck. Sometimes on islands, sometimes in rotten chests under the end of a limb of an old dead tree, just where the shadow falls at midnight, but mostly under the floor in haunted houses."
"Who hides it?"
"Well, robbers, of course. Who'd you reckon? Sunday school superintendents?"
"I don't know. If it was mine, I wouldn't hide it. I'd spend it and have a good time.
So would I. But robbers don't do that way. They always hide it and leave it there."
"Don't they come after it anymore?"
"No, they think they will, but they generally forget the marks, or else they die. Anyway, it lays there a long time and gets rusty, and by and by somebody finds an old yellow paper that tells how to find the marks, a paper that's got to be ciphered over about a week, 'cause it's mostly signs and hieroglyphics."
"Which?"
"Hieroglyphics. Pictures and things, you know, that don't seem to mean anything."
"Have you got one of them papers, Tom?"
"No."
"Well, then, how are you going to find the marks?"
"I don't want any marks. They always bury it under a haunted house or on an island or under a dead tree that's got one limb sticking out. Well, we've tried Jackson's Island a little, and we can try it again sometime. And there's the old haunted house up the Stillhouse branch, and there's lots of dead limb trees, dead loads of them."
"Is it under all of them?" "How you talk."
"No!"
"Well, then, how are you going to know which one to go for?"
"Go for all of them.
What, Tom? It'll take all summer."
"Well, what of it? Suppose you find a brass pot with $100 in it, all rusty and gray, or a rotten chest full of diamonds. How's that?"
Huck's eyes glowed.
"That's bully. Plenty bully enough for me. Just you give me the $100 and I don't want no diamonds."
"All right. But I bet you I ain't gonna throw off on diamonds. Some of 'em's worth $20 apiece. There ain't any hardly but's worth 6 bits or a dollar."
"No. Is that so?"
"Certainly. Anybody'll tell you so. Ain't you ever seen one, Huck?"
"Not as I remember."
"Oh, kings have slathers of 'em."
"Well, I don't know no kings, Tom."
"I reckon you don't. But if you was to go to Europe, you'd see a raft of 'em hopping around."
"Do they hop?"
"Hop?
Your granny, no! Well, what did you say they did for?"
"Shucks, I only meant you'd see 'em. Not hopping, of course. What do they want to hop for? But, I mean, you just see 'em. Scattered around, you know, in a kind of a general way. Like that old humpbacked Richard."
"Richard? What's his other name?"
"He didn't have any other name. Kings don't have any but a given name."
"No?
But they don't."
"Well, if they like it, I'm all right, but I don't want to be a king and have only just a given name, like a nigger."
"But say, where are you going to dig first?"
"Well, I don't know. Suppose we tackle that old dead limb tree on the hill t'other side of Stillhouse Branch."
"I'm agreed."
So they got a crippled pick and a shovel and set out on their 3-mile tramp. They arrived hot and panting and threw themselves down in the shade of a neighboring elm to rest and have a smoke.
"I like this," said Tom.
"So do I." "Say, Huck, if we find a treasure here, what are you going to do with your share?"
"Well, I'll have pie and a glass of soda every day, and I'll go to every circus that comes along. I bet I'll have a gay time."
Well, ain't you going to save any of it?
Save it? What for?
Why, so as to have something to live on by and by.
Oh, that ain't any use. Pap would come back to this year town someday and get his claws on it if I didn't hurry up, and I tell you, he'd clean it out pretty quick.
What are you going to do with yourn, Tom?
I'm going to buy a new drum and a sure enough sword and a red necktie and a bullpup and get married.
Married?
That's it.
Tom, you...
Why, you ain't in your right mind.
Wait, you'll see.
That's the foolishest thing you could do. Look at Pap and my mother.
Fight?
Why, they used to fight all the time. I remember mighty well.
That ain't anything.
The girl I'm going to marry won't fight. Tom, I reckon they're all alike. They'll all comb a body. Now, you better think about this a while. I tell you, you better.
What's the name of the gal?
It ain't a gal at all. It's a girl.
It's all the same, I reckon. Some says gal, some says girl. Both is right like enough. Anyway, what's her name, Tom?
I'll tell you sometime.
Not now.
All right, that'll do. Only if you get married, I'll be more lonesomer than ever.
No, you won't. You'll come and live with me. Now, stir out of this, and we'll go to digging.
They worked and sweated for a half an hour. No result. They toiled another half hour. Still no result. Huck said,
"Do they always bury it as deep as this?"
"Sometimes. Not always. Not generally. I reckon we haven't got the right place."
So they chose a new spot and began again. The labor dragged a little, but still they made progress. They pegged away in silence for some time. Finally, Huck leaned on his shovel, swabbed the beaded drops from his brow with his sleeve, and said,
"Where are you going to dig next after we get this one?"
"I reckon maybe we'll tackle the old tree that's over yonder on Cardiff Hill, back of the widow's."
"I reckon that'll be a good one. But won't the widow take it away from us, Tom? It's on her land."
"She take it away?
Maybe she'd like to try it once. Whoever finds one of these hid treasures, it belongs to him. It don't make any difference whose land it's on."
That was satisfactory. The work went on. By and by, Huck said,
"Blame it, we must be in the wrong place again. What do you think?"
"It is mighty curious, Huck. I don't understand it. Sometimes witches interfere. I reckon maybe that's what's the trouble now."
"Shucks, witches ain't got no power in the daytime."
"Well, that's so. I didn't think of that. Oh, I know what the matter is. What a blamed lot of fools we are. You got to find out where the shadow of the limb falls at midnight, and that's where you dig."
"Well, then, confound it, we fooled away all this work for nothing. Now, hang it all, we got to come back in the night. It's an awful long way. Can you get out?"
"I bet I will. We've got to do it tonight, too, because if somebody sees these holes, they'll know in a minute what's here, and they'll go for it."
"Well, I'll come around and meow tonight."
"All right, let's hide the tools in the bushes."
The boys were there that night, about the appointed time. They sat in the shadow, waiting. It was a lonely place, and an hour made solemn by old traditions. Spirits whispered in the rustling leaves. Ghosts lurked in the murky nooks. The deep baying of a hound floated up out of the distance. An owl answered with his sepulchral note. The boys were subdued by these solemnities and talked little. By and by they judged that 12 had come. They marked where the shadow fell and began to dig. Their hopes commenced to rise. Their interest grew stronger, and their industry kept pace with it. The hole deepened and still deepened, but every time their hearts jumped to hear the pick strike upon something, they only suffered a new disappointment. It was only a stone or a chunk. At last, Tom said,
"It ain't any use, Huck. We're wrong again."
"Well,
but we can't be wrong.
We spotted the shatter to a dot."
"I know it. But then, there's another thing."
"What's that?"
"Why, we only guessed at the time. Like enough, it was too late or too early."
Huck dropped his shovel.
"That's it,"
said he.
"That's the very trouble. We got to give this one up. We can't ever tell the right time. And besides, this kind of thing's too awful here this time of night with witches and ghosts fluttering around. So I feel as if something's behind me all the time. And I'm afeard to turn around because maybe there's others in front awaiting for a chance. I've been creeping all over ever since I got here."
"Well, I've been pretty much so too, Huck. They must always put in a dead man when they bury a treasure under a tree to look out for it."
"Lordy!"
"Yes, they do. I've always heard that."
"Tom, I don't like to fool around much where there's dead people. A body's bound to get into trouble with them, sure.
I don't like to stir them up either. Suppose this one here was to stick his skull out and say something."
"Oh, don't, Tom. It's awful."
"Well, it just is. Huck, I don't feel comfortable a bit.
Say, Tom, let's give this place up and try somewhere else."
"Well, all right. I reckon we better."
"What'll it be?"
Tom considered a while and then said,
"The haunted house. That's it."
"Blame it, I don't like haunted houses, Tom. Why, they're a darn sight worse than dead people. Dead people might talk, maybe, but they don't come sliding around in a shroud when you ain't noticing and peep over your shoulder all of a sudden and grit their teeth the way a ghost does. I couldn't stand such a thing as that, Tom. Nobody could."
"Well, yes, but Huck, ghosts don't travel around only at night. They won't hinder us from digging there in the daytime."
"Well, that's so.
But you know mighty well people don't go about that haunted house in the day nor the night."
"Well, that's mostly because they don't like to go where a man's been murdered anyway. But nothing's ever been seen around that house except in the night. Just some blue light slipping by the windows. No regular ghosts."
"Well, where you see one of them blue lights flickering around, Tom, you can bet there's a ghost mighty close behind it. It stands to reason. Because you know that they don't anybody but ghosts use them."
"Yes, that's so. But anyway, they don't come around in the daytime, so what's the use of our being afeared?"
"Well, all right. We'll tackle the haunted house if you say so. But I reckon it's taking chances."
They had started down the hill by this time. There, in the middle of the moonlit valley below them, stood the haunted house, utterly isolated, its fences gone long ago, rank weeds smothering the very doorsteps, the chimney crumbled to ruin, the window sashes vacant, a corner of the roof caved in. The boys gazed a while, half expecting to see a blue light flit past a window. Then, talking in a low tone as befitted the time and the circumstances, they struck far off to the right to give the haunted house a wide berth and took their way homeward through the woods that adorned the rearward side of Cardiff Hill. Chapter 26. Real Robbers Seize the Box of Gold. About noon the next day, the boys arrived at the dead tree. They had come for their tools. Tom was impatient to go to the haunted house. Huck was measurably so also, but suddenly said,
"Looky here, Tom. Do you know what day it is?"
Tom mentally ran over the days of the week and then quickly lifted his eyes with a startled look in them.
"My, I never once thought of it, Huck."
"Well, I didn't either, but all at once it popped on to me that it was Friday."
"Blame it.
A body can't be too careful, Huck. We might have got into an awful scrape tackling such a thing on a Friday."
"Matt, better say we would. There's some lucky days, maybe, but Friday ain't."
"Any fool knows that. I don't reckon you was the first that found it out, Huck."
"Well, I never said I was, did I? And Friday ain't all, neither. I had a rotten bad dream last night. Dreamt about rats."
"No." "Ooh, sure sign of trouble. Did they fight?"
"No." "Well, that's good, Huck. When they don't fight, it's only a sign that there's trouble around, you know. All we got to do is to look mighty sharp and keep out of it. We'll drop this thing for today and play. Do you know Robin Hood, Huck?"
"No. Who's Robin Hood?"
"Why, he was one of the greatest men that was ever in England, and the best. He was a robber."
"Cracky. I wished I was."
"Who did he rob?"
"Only sheriffs and bishops and rich people and kings and such like. But he never bothered the poor. He loved them. He always divided up with them perfectly square."
"Well, he must have been a brick."
"I bet you he was, Huck. Oh, he was the noblest man that ever was. They ain't any such men now, I can tell you. He could lick any man in England with one hand tied behind him, and he could take his U-bow and plug a 10-cent piece every time, a mile and a half."
"What's a U-bow?"
"I don't know. Some kind of bow, of course. And if he hit that dime only on the edge, he would set down and cry and curse. But we'll play Robin Hood. It's nobby fun. I'll learn you."
"I'm agreed."
So they played Robin Hood all the afternoon, now and then casting a yearning eye down upon the haunted house and passing a remark about the morrow's prospects and possibilities there. As the sun began to sink into the west, they took their way homeward athwart the long shadows of the trees and soon were buried from sight in the forest of Cardiff Hill. On Saturday, shortly after noon, the boys were at the dead tree again. They had a smoke and a chat in the shade, and then dug a little in their last hole, not with great hope, but merely because Tom said there were so many cases where people had given up a treasure after getting down within 6 inches of it, and then somebody else had come along and turned it up with a single thrust of a shovel. The thing failed this time, however, so the boys shouldered their tools and went away, feeling that they had not trifled with fortune, but had fulfilled all the requirements that belong to the business of treasure hunting. When they reached the haunted house, there was something so weird and grisly about the dead silence that reigned there under the baking sun, and something so depressing about the loneliness and desolation of the place that they were afraid for a moment to venture in. Then they crept to the door and took a trembling peep. They saw a weed-grown, floorless room, unplastered, an ancient fireplace, vacant windows, a ruinous staircase, and here, there, and everywhere hung ragged and abandoned cobwebs. They presently entered, softly, with quickened pulses, talking in whispers, ears alert to catch the slightest sound and muscles tense and ready for instant retreat. In a little while, familiarity modified their fears, and they gave the place a critical and interested examination, rather admiring their own boldness and wondering at it, too. Next, they wanted to look upstairs. This was something like cutting off retreat, But they got to daring each other, and of course there could be but one result. They threw their tools into a corner and made the ascent. Up there were the same signs of decay. In one corner they found a closet that promised mystery, but the promise was a fraud. There was nothing in it. Their courage was up now and well in hand. They were about to go down and begin work when,
"Shh," said Tom.
"What is it?"
whispered Huck, blanching with fright.
"Shh. There. Hear it?"
"Yes. Oh, my. Let's run. Keep still. Don't you budge. They're coming right toward the door."
The boys stretched themselves upon the floor with their eyes to knot holes in the planking and lay waiting in a misery of fear.
They stopped. "No. Coming.
Oh, here they are. Don't whisper another word, Huck. My goodness, I wish I was out of this."
Two men entered. Each boy said to himself, "There's the old deaf and dumb Spaniard that's been about town once or twice lately. Never saw t'other man before." T'other was a ragged, unkempt creature with nothing very pleasant in his face. The Spaniard was wrapped in a serape. He had bushy white whiskers, long white hair flowed from under his sombrero, and he wore green goggles. When they came in, T'other was talking in a low voice. They sat down on the ground, facing the door with their backs to the wall, and the speaker continued his remarks. His manner became less guarded and his words more distinct as he proceeded.
"No," said he, "I've thought it all over and I don't like it. It's dangerous."
"Dangerous," grunted the deaf and dumb Spaniard, to the vast surprise of the boys. "Milksop."
This voice made the boys gasp and quake.
It was Injun Joe's.
There was silence for some time. Then Joe said,
"What's any more dangerous than that job up yonder? But nothing's come of it." "Well, that's different. Away up the river so, and not another house about, 'twon't ever be known that we tried anyway, long as we didn't succeed. Well, what's more dangerous than coming here in the daytime? Anybody would suspicion us that saw us."
"I know that, but there weren't any other place as handy after that fool of a job. I want to quit this shanty. I wanted to yesterday, only it weren't any use trying to stir out of here with those infernal boys playing over there on the hill right in full view."
Those infernal boys quaked again under the inspiration of this remark and thought how lucky it was that they had remembered it was Friday and concluded to wait a day. They wished in their hearts they had waited a year. The two men got out some food and made a luncheon. After a long and thoughtful silence, Injun Joe said,
"Look here, lad. You go back up the river where you belong. Wait there till you hear from me. I'll take the chances on dropping into this town just once more for a look. We'll do that dangerous job after I've spied around a little and think things look well for it. Then, for Texas, we'll leg it together."
This was satisfactory. Both men presently fell to yawning, and Injun Joe said,
"I'm dead for sleep. It's your turn to watch."
He curled down in the weeds and soon began to snore. His comrade stirred him once or twice, and he became quiet. Presently, the watcher began to nod. His head drooped lower and lower. Both men began to snore now. The boys drew a long, grateful breath. Tom whispered,
"Now's our chance. Come."
Huck said,
"I can't. I'd die if they was to wake."
Tom urged. Huck held back. At last, Tom rose slowly and softly and started alone.
But the first step he made wrung such a hideous creak from the crazy floor that he sank down almost dead with fright. He never made a second attempt. The boys lay there, counting the dragging moments, till it seemed to them that time must be done, and eternity growing gray. And then they were grateful to note that at last the sun was setting. Now one snore ceased. Injun Joe sat up, stared around, smiled grimly upon his comrade, whose head was drooping upon his knees, stirred him up with his foot and said,
"Here! You're a watchman, ain't you? All right, though. Nothing's happened." "My, have I been asleep?"
"Oh, partly, partly. Nearly time for us to be moving, pard. What'll we do with what little swag we've got left?"
"I don't know. Leave it here as we've always done, I reckon. No use to take it away till we start south. 650 in silver, something to carry."
"Well, all right. It won't matter to come here once more."
"No, but I'd say come in the night as we used to do. It's better."
"Yes. But look here. It may be a good while before I get the right chance at that job. Accidents might happen. 'Tain't in such a very good place. We'll just regularly bury it, and bury it deep."
"Good idea," said the comrade, who walked across the room, knelt down, raised one of the rearward hearthstones, and took out a bag that jingled pleasantly.
He subtracted from it $20 or $30 for himself and as much for Injun Joe, and passed the bag to the latter, who was on his knees in the corner now, digging with his bowie knife. The boys forgot all their fears, all their miseries in an instant. With gloating eyes, they watched every movement. Luck! The splendor of it was beyond all imagination. $600 was money enough to make half a dozen boys rich. Here was treasure hunting under the happiest auspices. There would not be any bothersome uncertainty as to where to dig. They nudged each other every moment, eloquent nudges, and easily understood, for they simply meant, "Oh, but ain't you glad now we're here?" Joe's knife struck upon something.
"Hello," said he.
"What is it?" said his comrade.
"Half-rotten plank."
"No, it's a box, I believe.
Here, bear a hand and we'll see what it's here for. Never mind, I've broke a hole."
He reached his hand in and drew it out.
"Man, it's money!"
The two men examined the handful of coins. They were gold. The boys above were as excited as themselves and as delighted. Joe's comrade said,
"We'll make quick work of this. There's an old rusty pick over amongst the weeds in the corner, the other side of the fireplace. I saw it a minute ago."
He ran and brought the boys pick and shovel. Injun Joe took the pick, looked it over critically, shook his head, muttered something to himself, and then began to use it. The box was soon unearthed. It was not very large. It was iron-bound and had been very strong before the slow years had injured it. The men contemplated the treasure a while in blissful silence.
"Pard, there's thousands of dollars here," said Injun Joe.
"'Twas always said that Merle's gang used to be around here one summer," the stranger observed.
"I know it," said Injun Joe, "and this looks like it, I should say. Now you won't need to do that job."
The half-breed frowned, said he. "You don't know me. Least, you don't know all about that thing. 'Tain't robbery altogether. It's revenge."
And a wicked light flamed in his eyes.
"I'll need your help in it. When it's finished, then Texas. Go home to your Nance and your kids and stand by till you hear from me."
"Well, if you say so. What'll we do with this? Bury it again?" Yes.
Ravishing delight overhead.
No, by the great Sachem, no.
Profound distress overhead.
I'd nearly forgot. That pick had fresh earth on it.
The boys were sick with terror in a moment.
What business has a pick and shovel here? What business with fresh earth on them? Who brought them here, and where are they gone? Have you heard anybody? Seen anybody? What, bury it again and leave them to come and see the ground disturbed? Not exactly. Not exactly. We'll take it to my den. Why, of course. Might have thought of that before. You mean, number one? No. Number two, under the cross. The other place is bad. Too common.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please insert disc number 7.